I'd like to turn you to the second book of Samuel. 2 Samuel, and we will read a part of chapter 17 and chapter 18. 2 Samuel, chapter 17, beginning to read at verse 22. Then David arose, and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan by the morning light. There lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died, and was buried in the sepulchre of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab. And Amasa was a man's son whose name was Ithra, an Israelite that went in to Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. And it came to pass, when David was come to Mahanaim, that Shobi, the son of Nahash of Rabbah, of the children of Ammon, and Machir, the son of Amiel of Lo-debar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite of Rogelim, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulse and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kine for David and for the people that were with him to eat. For they said, "The people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." And David numbered the people that were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said unto the people, "I will surely go forth with you myself also." But the people answered, "Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us. Neither if half of us die, will they care for us. But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore now it is better that thou succour us out of the city." And the king said unto them, "What seemeth you best, I will do." And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. And now let us turn to the book of Psalms and to Psalm 63. Psalm 63. It is entitled thus, "A Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah." O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee, in a dry and thirsty land where no water is, to see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. Because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Thus will I bless thee while I live, I will lift up my hands in thy name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips, when I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. Because thou hast been my help, therefore in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. My soul followeth hard after thee, thy right hand upholdeth me. But those that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for foxes. But the king shall rejoice in God. Every one that sweareth by him shall glory. But the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped. And may the Lord bless to us and grant us each one an understanding of his own most holy word. Amen. Now, in our previous study in these Psalms of David's life, we came to the conclusion of the seventh psalm, which we observed David to have been inspired to write on this occasion of the dreadful coup that was mounted by his son, which obliged him to flee from Jerusalem. And we have seen how the theme of judgment, an important though much neglected theme in modern Christendom, is the substance of the greater part of this psalm. And in verses 14 through 17, we noted that sin, as it is here described, has a life cycle. Rarely is it that sin arrives or is committed, fully formed out of nowhere, so to speak. There is a gestation described in verse 14, mischief being conceived and iniquity being travailed or labored with and falsehood being delivered. And we saw how that this truth is borne out by James in his epistle also, as by countless examples of sin that we may trace, not least in David's own life and bitter past experience. But knowing these things, my friends, and knowing the pattern of them, the Lord gives us a great advantage in our combat with sin and against temptation, for that it may be nipped in the bud before it develops or worsens or comes to a ghastly fruition. We noted then this statement that is made in verses 15 and 16 of the way that sin has of turning to injure and to harm those that gave it being. And this cycle which is here described is so often seen to play out. And of course, tragically, David could see this in his own life, though the Lord had graciously delivered and redeemed him from it, yet nevertheless he had proved it to be so. His own failures in respect of his polygamy, in respect of the indiscipline in his family, the failure to deal with Amon and then with Absalom. Now it is David who is fleeing from his own son. And likewise, we saw certain cases, as in those who sought the life of Daniel at a time in Persia, Haman in his designs against Mordecai, Jacob, and then his own sons, both committing crimes of deception and then themselves becoming victims of deception in their turn. This solemn warning being borne out both by this psalm and by the historical events that we see it to accompany. But the psalm ends on a note of praise, praise on account of the Lord outworking his judgments, the Lord acting according to his holy standard of righteousness. And we saw an echo of these same sentiments at the end of the scriptures, indeed, prophesying for us the end of time and granting a glimpse of those scenes in heaven at the last, where in Revelation 15 and 16 and 19 we heard those songs of praise and exaltation being made unto God for the ultimate outworking of his judgments and for his justice being performed at last and prevailing. Well, sufficient to conclude our considerations of the seventh psalm. This evening we have read Psalm 63. And this, in the purposes of God, will be the last in this series of psalms that we have considered, 14 in total, of these psalms which bear autobiographical or historical titles from the life of David. You may note at your leisure that there is one other psalm in these 150 that has a not dissimilar title, but that one is expressed more generically and does not mention David by name, and so that one we have omitted. But here in Psalm 63, we have this heading, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. Now, this is quite a short and perfunctory title, and there has been considerable speculation as to exactly what it might have reference to, and to when and where it might belong in the life of David. But having considered the various arguments about it, I have elected to put it here at the very last of all, and I trust, as you will see, with good reason. So a location is given us. We are told that this pertained to a time when David was in the wilderness of Judah. Now, properly speaking, this name was given to a region of country away to the south and east of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and the tribal territory of Judah and the line of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. And a part of this area, certainly in David's day, and especially so now, in spite of development and so forth, was largely desert in the traditional sense, a very dry and barren region, particularly, of course, around the Dead Sea, that scene of the destruction of the cities of the plain, forever after, covered in these salt deposits with very little in the way of vegetation or of animal life being sustained there, and, of course, quite a hot region in terms of its temperature and climate as well. And so this region was sometimes referred to as the wilderness of Judah. And it is not unreasonable to suppose that David, in his flight from Jerusalem and needing to find a place to cross the River Jordan, may indeed have gone southwards first and to have crossed over the Jordan River somewhere in this particular area in order to get over to the other side. But you see, having crossed over the Jordan and having got that physical or geographical barrier between himself and his pursuing enemies under the hand of Absalom, David was not yet out of trouble, because both sides of the Dead Sea were these desert regions. But then immediately to the east of the Dead Sea and to the east of the Jordan Valley, the land then became particularly mountainous and hilly, and rose up very sharply out of the Jordan Valley, going in an easterly direction. Now, this was a region of the land which at various times belonged to Israel, to the tribes of Israel, particularly to those that occupied the east side of the Jordan River. And they were, you remember, the tribes of Reuben and Gad and one half of the tribe of Manasseh. They held some of these regions at different times, but they did not have natural protection from the east or the north, and so they were often lost to other nations, such as the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Syrians, and the Assyrians and the Babylonians. In times of war, they were often the first territories to be lost by Israel. Well, during the time of David's kingdom, they had and remained later under his control. But they were generally regarded as somewhat wild country. And they were mountainous. In some regions, they were heavily wooded. Other regions of them were considered very fertile, and they sustained cattle and bred particularly large and strong breeds of cattle. And so Bashan and Gilead belonged to this region, and the cattle or the bulls of that region were famed for their size and their quality. And various characters we know came from this region too, not least, of course, the prophet Elijah, who, when he appeared west of the Jordan and made his way to the king's palace at Samaria, must have cut quite a striking figure, being dressed in the rustic clothing of those that belonged to Gilead and these somewhat remote and disputable eastern mountainous lands. Now, these were known as wilderness too, although not in the sense of a desert, but being unpopulated and remote. And so you will notice in the description we read in 2 Samuel 17 at verse 29, these individuals who took pity on David, they said, "The people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." So even once he had passed through the region of desert, and even after he had crossed over Jordan, David and his companions then had to tackle the hills and the mountains to the east as they continued to travel in that direction away from Jerusalem, away from Absalom and his pursuing armies. Now, this was evidently a very arduous trip for them to make. And the people who were with David were suffering on that account, in spite of some provision that they had received at the hands of others along the way. But ultimately, they gain an important town, the town of Mahanaim. And here was a little area of population. We read there, chapter 17 of 2 Samuel, verse 24, and David came to Mahanaim. But it was obviously a town of some size. It was defensible. It had walls and gates. We read of those a few verses later on in 2 Samuel 18. And so at last, David had come to a place where he could seek refuge. And remarkably, you notice, support and aid was given to David again at this time from, once more, very unlikely sources or people. For as David approached Mahanaim and came to the city, perhaps not knowing quite what he might meet there, whether they would be friendly or not, whether they would be receptive or not, whether they would be favorable to David, who was ostensibly their king, or whether they had turned to serve other of the neighboring nations, or indeed perhaps had already somehow been won to Absalom's cause, he could not tell in advance. But arriving there, he is greeted by these different characters. We are told of Shobi, the son of Nahash, of Rabbah, and he was an Ammonite of all people. So although belonging to this foreign neighboring territory, he nevertheless aids David. We meet Machir, the son of Amiel, of Lo Debar, and Debar was another of the towns of this region, and a man called Barzillai, the Gileadite. And again, Gilead was another of the towns in this mountainous region. And these three individuals take pity upon David and the company that were with David, and we read in verses 28 and 29 that remarkable inventory of things which they provided David with, proving the fertility and the produce of that region, this abundance of various things that they brought and supplied the people, taking pity upon them, for they said, "The people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And so you see that this title to Psalm 63 and this reference to wilderness or the wilderness of Judah is not inappropriate for this period in David's life. But you may recall that he had been in the deserts of Judah several times before, several years previously when he was on the run from Saul. He sought refuge in the wilderness of Judah. And so it might be asked, well, does not this 63rd Psalm sit better at an earlier stage in David's life? But there is another little piece of evidence in this psalm that suggests otherwise, and it is the very last verse, verse 11, where David seems to speak of himself in the third person and says, "But the king shall rejoice in God." And it is generally accepted that he is here making a reference to himself under the title of king, which must therefore mean that this 63rd Psalm belongs to that period in his life after he was crowned and after his accession to the throne. And so coupling that detail with such expressions as those that seek my soul to destroy it in verse 9, and also him speaking about longing for God in a dry and thirsty land where no water is, that combination of details seems to fit best to this stage in David's life and this time of his flight from Absalom into the eastern reaches of the Jordan River. Well, now, it is remarkable to trace the good hand of God upon him at this particular time, because David had no expectation of it, necessarily. These were difficult regions of country, ungovernable to a certain extent, neighboring to places like Edom and Ammon and Moab, and they might be at least as hostile to David as was his own home city of Jerusalem under the control of Absalom. And yet here is the wonder of the providence of God to David, that in this wilderness place, in this mountainous and inhospitable region, in every sense of that word, that David found great provision, and that he found friendship and kindness from these unexpected sources, and this great abundance was given him, and that so very importantly, he gained the town of Mahanaim and could take refuge there. Now, meanwhile, we need to cast our eyes westward and see what Absalom has been doing all this time. And if you recall back to when we started looking at Psalm 7, we read in 2 Samuel 17 some of the details that applied to that stage in David's history, and how that Absalom had seized Jerusalem and the vast majority of the population rallied to his cause, but that David had a few friends who very bravely and at great risk to themselves remained in Jerusalem. And so those two men who were priests and their sons stayed behind in the city, and this man Hushai stayed there too to do what he could to favor David's cause in secret. Now, this, of course, he did, because when Ahithophel, that treacherous counselor who had defected to Absalom, when he advised Absalom quite sensibly to pursue after David straight away while he was still weak, while he was still in flight, and to rout and put to death David and his followers before they crossed the Jordan, Hushai advised otherwise, and very cannily suggested that if David was found almost straight away, he would be in a state of great anger and wrath at having been displaced, and might fight the more fiercely for that. And he counseled Absalom instead to wait and to gather a larger army, whilst dispatching the two sons of the priests, Zadok and Abiathar's sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, and they ran off eastward in order to get a message to David and to warn him not to delay, but that Absalom was mounting this attack against them and that they should get over the Jordan as quickly as possible to be safe. And it seems that Hushai's counsel to delay was particularly successful, because it must have taken some period of time for David and his company to get out of the Jordan Valley and through that mountainous region and to reach Mahanaim. And all that time, they were quite vulnerable to attack from the rear and from Absalom and his forces if they had crossed over the Jordan in pursuit. But mercifully, again, God preserved them in the wilderness. And those same mountains that would be difficult for David and his companions would be at least as difficult for Absalom and his forces. They would be slowed down as well. But then David reaches Mahanaim, and at last there is a degree of safety and defense from Absalom, whatever he chose next to do. But the Lord's mercies to David continued, and these providences continue to multiply to David, because still time passes and Absalom and his forces do not yet appear. And so there is time for David to get organized and to sort himself out. And it is evident that with the passage of time, more and more individuals were either coming out in support of David or were perhaps thinking twice about supporting Absalom and were changing sides. Because whilst those who fled Jerusalem with David originally had been relatively few in number, as time passes, it works in David's favor. And you note there in chapter 18 how his numbers had grown to the point that he could count them in the thousands ultimately. And so this too was a great blessing and comfort for David. Absalom, it seems, was further delayed because, of course, Joab, the original captain of Israel's armies, had stayed loyal to David and had gone with David. And so whilst the rank and file of the troops remained and flocked to Absalom, he had no one to lead them. And so he picks another man who happened to be a distant relative of Joab, this man Amasa, and he has to appoint him as commander over the armies in order to be able to go after David in pursuit and to wage war against David. But ultimately, you notice there in verse 24 of chapter 17, Absalom passed over Jordan too, he and all the men of Israel with him. But David had this window of time and of opportunity, and he took occasion to divide his own forces into three bands, each under a different captain. There was Joab, there was Joab's brother Abishai, and there was this man we met once before, Ittai the Gittite, and these he puts in command each of a third of his forces. He was entirely planning to go out with them himself, but the people very wisely dissuade him from doing so, because they say, well, David, you are the chief prize, because they perhaps had not forgotten the fact that Absalom was the next in line to the throne, the next eldest of David's children anyway. So if David were to die in battle, then Absalom would be the heir apparent as well as the leader of this rebellion. And so they see the preservation of David's life as being very important indeed. They say, look, even if Absalom were to face the rest of the armies of Israel, his prime target is going to be you, and all his forces will be instructed to find you and to kill you regardless of the rest. And so David is to stay at Mahanaim instead, and to succor them from out of the city, which is this interesting expression used in verse 3 of 2 Samuel 18. And exactly what the people meant by this suggestion to David, we might speculate about. But as to what David did whilst he was here in Mahanaim and battle about to be joined, let me suggest that the best support that he could give, the best succor, the best sustenance that he could afford whilst not going to war himself, was that of prayer and seeking the Lord. And I think it not unreasonable to suggest that Psalm 63 may well have come into being as David was here in Mahanaim and reflecting upon his wilderness journey, the inevitable confrontation with Absalom, and his hopes and confidences in God concerning the future. Now, there is nothing coincidental about the scriptures, and no detail of it is given us without reason. And the fact that David is in Mahanaim, of all places, is worth reflecting upon. The origins of this place and its name goes right back to the book of Genesis. And here in Genesis chapter 32, we read something of it. Now, Jacob, the patriarch, if you recall, had spent a 20-year period working for his uncle Laban in the land of Haran, which was a long way to the north and east of Israel. And you know how that Jacob was double-crossed by his uncle on several matters and eventually decided to quit his uncle's service very rapidly and to flee with his wives and his children and his flocks and herds and to head back to Canaan, the country where he had left his father and mother and was, of course, the place that God had promised to them and where he ought really to have been all this time. Jacob was pursued by his uncle Laban. There was this confrontation between them, but then there was this eventual agreement that they would go their separate ways, Laban back to Haran, Jacob back to Canaan, and to part under generally amicable terms. And this happened. And the location where they eventually parted company was near to this area where we find David in our portion tonight. And here, Jacob is drawing nearer, of course, to Canaan and facing another confrontation with his estranged brother Esau, who had made it entirely clear that he would like to have killed Jacob. And on that account, Jacob, we find, did something not dissimilar from that which David does with his armies, in that he divides them into separate companies in order that they cannot all be attacked together. And so in Genesis 32, that is what Jacob does. David divided his army into three, facing the threat of Absalom. Jacob divided his company into two in the face of the threat of his brother Esau, and marveled to think that there were enough people associated with him and flocks and herds to form two camps. Verse 9 of Genesis 32, "And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saidst unto me, Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou saidst, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. This particular location, then, where Jacob divided himself into two companies, became known by this place, by this name of Mahanaim, which literally translates as a plurality of camps, as several companies. That is the meaning of it in its simplest sense. And we can see how fitting a name and title it was, both for Jacob, who divided his company into two, or for David, that divided his company into three. Both of the men reflecting upon God's goodness to them in increasing their numbers, and those who supported them and those who were upon their side, even in the face of adversity and trouble and hostility which they had faced. But that was not the primary reason that Jacob gave this location that name. For whilst it was the place where he divided his company into a multiplicity of camps, prior even to doing that, he had given the place this name, because we read in the opening verses of Genesis chapter 32, "And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, This is God's host. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim." Jacob was granted this vision of angels as he and the people and herds that were with him drew nigh to this place. This revelation was granted to him of the host of God. And Jacob became aware that he was not the only person there, that his was not the only company of people there, that the Lord was in this remote and mountainous place, that the Lord's hosts were in that place, albeit invisibly, as much as was Jacob and those that went with him. And he was moved to call it Mahanaim on that account, because the presence of God was there. And even when Jacob's people were all combined together into one company, there was still a multiplicity of companies, because God's presence was undeniably in that place, and a great company of angels. And in the purposes of the Lord, perhaps 1,000 years and more later, David comes to this same place. He comes to this very location, which for the intervening centuries has kept its name Mahanaim, a place of encampments, a place of multiple armies. And surely David, who was versed in the scriptures, who was a believing man of God, who was a prophet, could not have failed to reflect upon the history of this location. For here he was, with a force larger than it had been, but still perhaps nowhere near the size of the one that threatened him. And here he is dividing it into sections, even as the patriarch Jacob had done in the face of a threat generations before, at this very same place, Mahanaim, a place which Jacob named first, David must have remembered, because the presence of God was seen there, and the armies of heaven, and these hosts of angels. And this is the context of the 63rd Psalm. This is the background to it. And you see how its language is so befitting to this part of David's biography. He has been, Psalm 63 and verse 1, in a dry and thirsty land where no water is. He had come through those deserts of Judah. He had gone through those hostile regions. He had come up into this mountainous and hill country, which was described as a wilderness. And he and the people with him had suffered greatly on account of that journey. They were looked upon by those observing people as hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And yet, in this place of all places, David says, O God, thou art my God, early will I seek thee, even in such a place as this. And here was a region of the country which, perhaps in every sense of the rather irreverent expression, might have been described as God forsaken. And yet, says David, I look for the Lord here, and I seek to see God in this place and in this situation. Indeed, verse 2, to see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen it in the sanctuary. There could hardly be anywhere more removed or more different from the sanctuary of the temple in Jerusalem than was this mountainous and wild region between the River Jordan and Mahanaim. But, says David, I as much expect to see the power and the glory of the Lord here as ever I have seen or comprehended it in the sanctuary of the temple. Because the circumstances are no obstacle for God, and the nature of the place in which I am found is no impediment to him. And the Lord is not limited by geographical location. The Lord is not obliged to operate only where the church is to be found, or where Christians are to be found, or where the situation seems favorable and conducive to religious exercise. No, says David, I seek God in this thirsty land, in this wilderness, and I expect to see his power and his glory, even as I saw it and have known it in the very heart of the temple, to prove that God is as much here as ever he is where the Ark of the Covenant is to be found, which you remember was ever symbolic of the presence of God to the Jews of old. But how foolish it would have been if in their minds they confined God to that one venue. For the Lord was to be found even here. Indeed, the Lord was most certainly to be found at Mahanaim, where Jacob had proved it so many centuries before. There was Jacob, his numbers grown, and yet facing a seemingly larger and insurmountable threat, dividing his company into those sections and commenting upon it, but being motivated, being comforted and encouraged so much more by the thought that the Lord was present with him there, that the hosts of God were present with him there. My friends, what Jacob witnessed in that place and at that time was a truth borne out on other occasions too. No doubt you remember the account of the prophet Elisha, whose life was sought by an enemy king whose forces surrounded him in a city. And Elisha had confidence in God, but his poor servant was beside himself and thought they were sure to be captured or worse, to be killed. And you recall how Elisha prayed to God, "Lord, open the young man's eyes." And his eyes being opened — they had been opened before, of course, they could only see enemies — but his eyes being opened to the spiritual reality of the situation, he beheld the chariots and horsemen of God surrounding the place, surrounding himself and Elisha. They that were for them were far greater than those that were against them. Here, in Elisha's case, as for Jacob in his case, as for David, now here at Mahanaim, once again, the truth applied equally. The true case was the same. Those who are for, those who are with the Lord's people, are more than those that are against them. Unseen they may be, but forever at hand they most certainly are, to borrow the language of the hymn. My friends, the people of God, even when they are gathered together in a company, even when we are together as we are in this place, our numbers are as nothing compared to the heavenly company that we have, to the presence and support of the Lord that we have. Because remember, my friends, that these Old Testament cases, as the Apostle reminds us, are our ensamples. They are written for our admonition. And we have seen how this glorious spiritual reality was true for Jacob, and he was given a vision whereby to glimpse it. It was true for Elisha and his servant, and vision was granted to him to see it. It was true for David, and though no vision was afforded, yet he firmly believes it, as the language of Psalm 63 shows and proves. But equally, my friends, and gloriously, it is true for us as well. It is true for us as a local church in this place. It is true for us individually as well as corporately, that we have the Lord's presence with us, that wheresoever we are, it is a multiple company, because there is us, there are those who humanly speaking are with us, but there are those who spiritually speaking are with us, the Lord and all the hosts that are at his disposal. My friends, let me conclude by reminding you of the language of the Song of Songs, chapter 6, where you remember the Lord and his church are depicted by this metaphorical love poem. And in the conclusion of chapter 6, where the bride, where the church has been described by various analogies as a Shulamite, as a woman from Tirzah, the same character, the same entity, namely the church, is also described as an army with banners in the Song of Songs 6 and verse 4. But what is still more telling is this concluding verse 13. "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. What will ye see in the Shulamite? As it were, the company of two armies." As it were, the company of two armies. And we might say, well, how is this possible? We see the church described as a woman. We see the church described as an army. And there it is, terrible as an army with banners, in chapter 6, verse 4. But how is it now described as a company of two armies? My friends, precisely because of the truth that we have just been considering, precisely because wheresoever the Lord's people are found, there the hosts of God encamp around the dwellings of the just, to borrow that paraphrase of Psalm 34. This was the truth that comforted David at this point in his life. This was the glorious truth that caused him to seek for God and to expect to find the Lord, even in the midst of a dry and thirsty land where no water is. This is why he was confident that he would see the power and glory of the Lord, that he would know the Lord's presence, that he would know the Lord's support, as much in times of adversity and of trial and of hostility and when surrounded by foes as at any other time. Because this is the nature of our God, my friends, and this the nature of his relationship with us and of ours to him. And we likewise may and must and can expect to see the power and the glory of the Lord surrounding us, and his aid and his angelic company aiding and assisting us even in the most hostile and trying of circumstances. So may we be blessed and encouraged by these words for his glory. Amen. Now we have in hymn 629 a lovely rendition of Psalm 63 by the hymn writer James Montgomery. Number 629. O God, thou art my God alone. Early to thee my soul shall cry, a pilgrim in a land unknown, a thirsty land whose springs are dry. Yet through this rough and thorny maze I follow hard on thee, my God. Thy hand unseen upholds my ways. I safely tread where thou hast trod. The hymn 629.
Grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with us all. Amen. Lord.